Okay, so today we're very happy to have Asher Berling as our speaker. Asher is currently a postdoc at NYU, but he will soon be moving to Fermilab for a faculty position. And today he will tell us about heterodyne detection of axions. Please, Asher, take it away.
Okay. Thanks for the invitation. Of course, I wish I was there in person, but what I'm going to be telling you about today, I should say, as I start, feel free to interrupt me as we go along. What I'm going to be telling you about today is something based on these two papers listed down here, something that we refer to as heterodyne detection, or else sometimes referred to as frequency conversion, which is a new way to look for very light axion dark matter using things like accelerator cavities. So instead of, you know, the same kinds of cavities that are usually strung together to build something like a LINAC, but instead just using one of these things to look for very light axions that couple to electromagnetism. So let's get started, and I'll just give you a brief overview and motivation for what axions are. And from a dark matter perspective, this can be done quite simply by stating that the fact that galaxies exist the way they do implies that if dark matter is some particle below the EV scale, it has to be a boson. So let's call this boson A as a stand-in for axion. And this is just coming from the statistics of fermions versus bosons. If you try to pack in a huge number of particles, very light dark matter particles, to explain the mass of some galaxy, to efficiently pack in the galaxies, these things have to be bosons. Now, in various theoretical constructions, light bosons naturally arise if there's something like the pions of QCD, more specifically something like a pseudo-Goldstone remnant of some spontaneously broken approximate global symmetry. These bosons are naturally light, that I'm going to refer to as axions. And moreover, there's a natural explanation for why they're weakly coupled to normal matter if this new symmetry breaking scale F here is at a very high scale in nature. So these things couple in a particular way in the form of higher dimensional operators that scale like one over this new symmetry breaking scale. And that's a natural kind of explanation for how these things could be so feebly coupled to normal matter that we're familiar with. At the onset, there are various ways these things could couple to standard model currents. A few examples are shown here. This first coupling, the GG dual or the QCD field strength, is the defining coupling of the so-called QCD axion, dynamically explaining why the neutron electric dipole moment is small, solving the so-called strong CP problem. I'll be focusing mainly today on this analogous coupling to photons, the coupling to FF dual, for a couple of reasons. In fact, it's quite generic, and this coupling is in fact just radiatively generated at an appreciable level by this QCD coupling. And it also just on its own implies interesting detectable signatures that I'd like to focus on for today. So the point of today's talk is to tell you about this coupling, what the implications are, how to best look for it. But before I get there, let me just pull back for a second so we can all get on the same page and quickly review how should we think about these axions if they make up the dark matter of our galaxy. And the effect that most experiments try to exploit is the fact that you require a huge density of these particles to explain the mass of our galaxy if these particles are very light. And what this means is that you're typically motivated to consider the case where the occupation number of these particles per quantum state exceeds one by a large margin. And just in the same way that you can think of an electromagnetic wave as some classical field instead of a bunch of individual photons, you can think about this population of axions in our galaxy as something like a classical field with certain wave-like properties. So what this means more specifically is that on short timescales, which is what's shown on this little zoom-in figure on the top left here, on short timescales, you can think about this axion population as behaving like a perfect cosine with some amplitude and phase, oscillating with an angular frequency controlled by the rest mass of these particles because they're non-relativistic in our galaxy today. The characteristic expectation for this amplitude, the RMS of this amplitude, is just controlled by the energy density of these particles and their mass. And for the wide range of masses that I'll be considering today, translated into frequency units, this will span roughly an inverse month to a gigahertz. Now, this statement about the axion looking like a cosine is only true provided that you observe it up to a so-called axion coherence time denoted as tau sub a. So zooming out and looking at it for a longer period of time, you'll note that on timescales longer than this coherence time, you start to notice the stochastic property of these particles if they're drawn from some velocity distribution in our galaxy. More specifically, this coherence time is roughly just dictated by the inverse kinetic energy of these particles. And translated into time units, this will span roughly a millisecond for the heaviest masses that I'll be considering, up to hundreds of thousands of years for the lightest viable dark matter masses. So you should think about, after this point, at every tau sub a, this amplitude, A0, and this phase is being randomly drawn from some distribution. But the important point is that on these timescales here, we can think about this field as some coherent field on macroscopic timescales oscillating within a terrestrially interesting frequency range. So this is just to get us on the same page how to think about these fields. The main point of what I'm going to be telling you about today is how to go after the case where this field couples to photons. And this is the parameter space spanned by that coupling, spanned by the axion photon interaction Gia gamma gamma and the axion mass in units of EV, where Gia gamma gamma is just parameterizing this dimension 5 interaction between axions and photons. So it has units of inverse mass. And you can think of a small coupling as essentially arising from a new large symmetry breaking scale associated with this axion that you can read off on the right axis here. Furthermore, you can translate every axion mass to a corresponding frequency at which this field is oscillating, and that can be read off on the top axis. So there are a couple of important points to first take note of in this parameter space. One is that, as far as we are aware today, there are two main motivated regions of parameter space. One is this blue strip, and said quickly, there's a class of cosmologies to explain how these axions could be produced in the early universe and be the dark matter today in somewhat of a kind of simple way. So this is a dark matter or a cosmological target along this blue strip. Along this orange strip, this is the canonical parameter space to be consistent with coupling the QCD. So this is the parameter space of the so-called QCD axion, where you're solving the strong CP problem in a traditional way. And beyond that, you'll note that these gray regions are current limits, current exclusions. And most interesting within that is the fact that resonant cavity experiments like ADMX are beginning to carve into this QCD axion parameter space for the very first time, after making tremendous progress over the past few decades. But let's say we're interested in kind of further down the road. If you ask what experiments exist in some developed prototype stage today, what are they gonna do, let's say, in the coming decade or so? A nice example of that at small masses is the so-called dark matter radio or DM radio experiment, which is hosted at SLAC in Stanford, with some ultimate projected sensitivity shown here in red, which you should think of as maybe a decade or so off. And the reach, the projections are especially impressive, but you can still see even this still leaves us wanting to do a lot more interesting physics. So I'm gonna use this to organize three main goals to strive for, to try to achieve with new ideas for different detection strategies. And I should say, as we go along, I'll explain how DM radio works, but just for the time being, I'm going to skip over that part. So goal number one, to go beyond what these experiments are going to try to do, is to try to gain access to the smallest viable dark matter masses. If we can go down to the lightest viable dark matter masses, what cosmologists refer to as fuzzy dark matter, that's especially interesting. This is a regime where the de Broglie wavelength of these particles is on the scale of small galaxies and potentially has interesting implications from the point of view of structure formation. Goal number two is to get a better scaling and sensitivity as a function of a small axion mass. More specifically, if the sensitivity was more aligned with this cosmological target in terms of its slope, that would allow us to cover more of that interesting part of parameter space. And goal number three is just to dig down deep into small couplings in a mass-independent way, especially in these masses around here, a little bit below a micro EV. If we can start digging down deep into this parameter space, that would allow us to test more of this QCD axion motivated target. So in fact, I'll be telling you how potentially all three of these goals can be achieved with a single cavity apparatus with some ultimate sensitivity shown here. This is abbreviated by an SRF cavity that stands for a superconducting radio frequency cavity. And the point of today's talk is to show you all the assumptions, really what's going in here when we're talking about these projections. So are there any questions so far? Okay, so to do this, to describe to you really what are the hidden assumptions going into this projection, the natural breakdown of what I'm going to be talking about today is first tell you how to think about the signal. How should we think about signals for axions coupled to photons in various different kinds of experiments? I'll motivate what I'm going to refer to as heterodyne detection or frequency conversion, and then argue why something like a superconducting radio frequency cavity, the same cavities we use to make accelerators, is in fact the ideal setting to look for this frequency conversion signal. And because the strength of any kind of experiment is intimately tied to the noise that it's subject to, I'll be spending some amount of time towards the end talking about various considerations of noise that are going to limit and essentially carve out the shape of the sensitivity in this parameter space. So let me just begin by describing to you some basic points about what these signals look like from the point of view of axions coupled to photons. So the simplest way to do this is to go back to the Lagrangian. So this is the Lagrangian of axions coupled to electromagnetism. And with a little bit of work, you can rewrite this to leading order like an effective current coupled to the vector potential, where this current J sub A is not a true current, but it just encapsulates the important axion physics. So it's roughly controlled by this axion photon interaction, G gamma gamma, whatever magnetic field happens to be present B, as well as the time derivative of the axion field. Now, what this means experimentally is, let's say you walk into a lab and you start driving a magnetic field at a frequency of your choice, some frequency omega zero. Now, presumably, cosmology has set up a background of axions for us, oscillating at the axion mass, whatever that mass happens to be. And if you take a look at this effective current, you'll note that it's roughly just controlled by the product of the B field and the axion field. What this means schematically is that these axions will source an effective current aligned with the spatial profile of that magnetic field that you're driving, with a time dependence that's controlled by the beats of these two frequencies, omega zero, the frequency of your choice, plus or minus an axion mass. Now, this is, once again, this is not a true current, but it's going to source real electromagnetic fields just like a current would. So in this case, we'll source an azimuthal axion-induced magnetic field, B sub A, with the same overall time dependence. Now, the important point is that we know how to look for such B fields. From Lenz's law, oscillating B fields can do work on a system in the form of an electromotive force. What this means is that the ideal detector is something that can resonantly match to the same frequency scale to resonantly draw power from this axion-induced B field. Now, along those lines, Lenz's law tells us that the size of this EMF, this axion-induced EMF, is just controlled by the time derivative of that B field, and that time derivative pulls out a single factor of the same linear combination of frequencies. Now, this might look like a very simple expression, but in fact, it's quite powerful. So this expression down here, you should think of as really the signal, this axion-induced EMF, and will allow us to understand parametrics in different kinds of experimental setups. So for that reason, let's keep it up at the top right here. Now, when thinking about the various attempts at trying to detect these kinds of axions, most experiments fall under one of two categories. In fact, the large majority of axion experiments would fall under the category of what I'm referring to as a static field resonator. This is where omega zero is zero by definition. They apply a big static B field to their resonator. And the reason for this is that it's easier to make a very large magnetic field if you don't have to oscillate it. It doesn't cost you any power. However, what I'm going to be advocating for in comparing to this is instead allowing your field to oscillate. So omega zero is not equal to zero. More specifically, we'll be interested in the regime where the axion is oscillating more slowly than the field that you're driving. I'll be referring to this as a heterodyne resonator, and I'll explain what that means. It's really just a fancy word borrowed from the field of signal processing, and I'll explain how that comes in. But when comparing these two setups, well, I should say at the beginning here, an example of each, for instance, is in fact on the static field side, is the same experiment that I was talking about before, DM radio at Slack, where the basic idea of that experiment is to apply a big static B field to something like an LC circuit resonator, something like a radio, where the resonant frequency of that circuit can be tuned by a judicious choice of the inductance or the capacitance. And typically these things can only be operated, let's say, at frequencies above a kilohertz, and I'll explain why that is. What I'll be talking about from the point of view of an oscillating or heterodyne resonator is just something like a radio frequency cavity. If you take a hollow conducting cavity if it's, you know, large, the resonant frequency of the modes that you'll excite parametrically are 1/1 the size of that cavity. So naturally oscillate in the radio frequency range at a gigahertz or so. So let's discuss some important differences between these two classes of experiments. The first one is the frequency of the signal. So in the static field limit, I can drop omega zero by definition. And what this means is that the frequency of my signal is solely dictated by the axion mass. What this means is that for every possible guess of what I think the axion mass is, I want to build a new resonator whose resonant frequency is chosen to match that axion mass. And this implies a couple things. One, it's slightly cumbersome to do, but two, it's very unfeasible to do at very low frequencies. It turns out to be very difficult to build things like LC circuits that can resonantly respond below a kilohertz. This is because you need so many wraps of wire. If you're talking about thousands of wraps of wire to wrap around your inductor to try to lower the resonant frequency, eventually things go awry. So these things can only efficiently respond to axion signals oscillating more rapidly than a kilohertz, corresponding to axions heavier than roughly 10 to the minus 12 electron volts. So these things are limited to operate within that regime. We can compare that to an oscillating field setup, where in the limit that the axion is oscillating much more slowly than omega zero, we see that our signal frequency is solely dictated by omega zero. What this means is, in principle, if we want to go after a very slowly oscillating axion, let's say down at a hertz, we can upconvert it into a more friendly frequency range if we oscillate our signal up at a gigahertz, oscillate our B field, omega zero, choose that to be up at a gigahertz. So this is what the word heterodyne really means. It means by you're taking for instance, a signal that might be oscillating in a difficult part of parameter space to couple to, and you're up converting it into a more friendly frequency range where you can more efficiently build good resonators to couple to that signal. So already at this level, we can see how we can achieve goal number one in an abstract way, gain access to small masses by up converting very slowly oscillating axions into a more friendly part of frequency space. Now, goal number two is slightly more subtle, but still more or less a very similar point, which is looking at the overall amplitude of this EMF. We see once again in the static field limit that the strength of the signal, the strength of this EMF, is suppressed by the small axion mass. And you can think about this, usually comes in like your signal power scaling like the size of your apparatus over the very large Compton wavelength of the axion field. So this is typically a geometric quantity much, much smaller than one for very light axions. To contrast this with, we see once again, if we allow the field to oscillate more rapidly than how rapidly the axion is oscillating, our signal power is approximately independent of the axion mass. So instead of scaling like the size of our detector over the Compton wavelength of the axion, which is a quantity much smaller than one, the signal power will scale like omega zero, a gigahertz, times the size of our detector, which can be an order one number. So at this level, you can completely undo a very strong geometric penalty that severely limits static field setups.
Sorry, won't the noise scale then also with frequency?
Not necessarily.
Hmm. But that seems counterintuitive. Presumably some sources of noise will have the same dependency that you pick up at the derivative, and then there's a power of frequency, no?
I'll give you an example, like something like thermal noise doesn't really care about the frequency.
Oh yeah, no, that for sure. But you're like something electronics, something like that, it will, right?
That's true. So in a sense, the way that I can compare this is, the idea here, I'll show you more concretely how this arises. The idea for a static field setup is you drive a big B field at zero and you look for a small signal at MA away from zero. But of course, there's no such thing as a static B field. Things can be oscillating around and things can put power. If you have an oscillating field, you're driving an omega zero and you're looking for a little signal MA away from omega zero. And a lot of these signal sources have analogs in both setups. But you're right. If you're oscillating a field, there can be new noise sources that have no analogs in these static field setups. An example of that, and I can talk more about this if you'd like, although I'm not going to mention it in too much detail, is the fact that you have some large oscillating signal now. You can talk about, you know, ripping electrons off the walls of your system. They're flying through your apparatus and they can deposit some energy. So by oscillating the signal, you can potentially introduce new noise sources. But most of the sources, I would argue, have analogs in both.
I see. Okay, thank you.
No problem.
Sure. May I also ask a question?
Sure.
Yeah, like following your logic, why am I not doing it for optical photons?
I would say the most obvious enhancement. Well, okay. So I haven't thought generally about how to apply this idea completely generally. So I don't know. It's worth talking about. Maybe we should talk about it more. I haven't thought too much about it at higher frequencies. Where you really gain is if you have, you're asking, why am I talking about a gigahertz here? Is that really your question?
Yeah, like if I just look at your blue circle, like you would be seemingly telling me that I should make omega not as big as I want.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it turns out that if you want a really good big resonator with big electromagnetic fields, the best example that we have, as I'll discuss, is something like an SRF cavity. Those things are big, they have the lowest loss, they have very big magnetic fields that are oscillating already. So they're kind of the natural arena. So that's why I've kind of put that implicit assumption here that we're going to be thinking about a gigahertz. But in principle, as long as the axion mass becomes much smaller than the frequency or the energy of a photon in your system, you can gain a parametric enhancement by increasing the energy of those photons. Because in a sense, a less fraction of the energy is coming from the rest mass of the axion.
Yeah.
My implicit assumption that I'm focusing on a gigahertz here is technologically driven. But I don't think there's a pure academic reason that you would have to choose something like a gigahertz.
I saw your like a colleague like Hongwan and Jesse, like they had these designs, which seems to be just doing it with optical photons.
Yeah. So one thing that changes when you go to higher frequencies is for some fixed amount of power or some fixed amount of energy, and you're talking about higher frequencies now, often you become like shot noise limited. So like Jesse and Hong Wan's system is limited by shot noise when you go into the optical frequencies, whereas that's typically not a concern when you're talking about, let's say, gigahertz frequencies. So things can change. And I think that's actually their limiting thing. Yeah, I don't want to derive some like kind of universal statement around that.
Thanks.
No problem. Okay, good. So I should say, keep asking me questions if any points aren't clear. The one point that I wanted to make about this enhancement in signal power that we're discussing is the fact that let's make this comparison now to static field cases, and let's make this comparison friendly. So let's talk about an axion mass at a kilohertz, which is where you can efficiently build LC circuits, and oscillating the field at a gigahertz, which is where cavities are going to want to live. That implies an enhancement in terms of total integrated signal power by 10 to the 6. So this is, I just want to emphasize, is a really big deal. You're completely undoing a geometric penalty. Isn't going to mean the experiment is necessarily better, but at least at this level, you see an obvious enhancement at the level of signal. And this just grows as you talk about smaller axion masses. And this is essentially the abstract reason for why you can get better scaling when you go to a heterodyne approach. You undo this large suppression that static field setups have to pay in the limit of a small axion mass. But this discussion has been somewhat abstract. So we can see these general arguments for why an oscillating field might be beneficial, but what's a concrete example of this heterodyne resonator? What's a more concrete way of how we could take advantage of these points? And to do that, let me talk about a specific setting for this strategy, which is using something like a radio frequency cavity. And I'm going to be referring to the signal as frequency conversion. So let's see how that arises. So the basic idea is to take a resonant cavity. And as you'll see, we're not going to try to match to the axion frequency by building a resonator whose resonant frequency is that axion mass. We're going to try to match to the axion mass by instead talking about two resonant modes of a single cavity whose frequency difference is comparable to the axion mass. And in that case, the signal will arise as converting power between two nearly degenerate modes, both near a gigahertz, but just split by an axion mass, whatever that mass happens to be. So let's step through that, see how it arises with a little bit more detail. So step number one, let's say, is at this cartoon level, take a cylindrical cavity and drive a large amount of power in some loud driven mode, what I'm calling mode zero. So let's say this mode is living at a gigahertz in terms of its frequency, and we've chosen to drive power in this so-called transverse magnetic mode, where by definition, the magnetic fields are azimuthal in this cylindrical cavity. Now, once again, similar to the signal to what I was describing before, if there's an axion present, this is going to source an effective current that follows azimuthally that magnetic field that you're driving with a time dependence that's controlled by the beats of a gigahertz plus or minus an axion mass. Now, what this means is if in the very same cavity, if there's an additional mode, mode one, that's initially not being driven, we try to not couple to that, let's say, but it's initially very, very quiet, and is also not living at a gigahertz, but let's say is at a gigahertz plus an axion mass, is slightly shifted up in terms of its resonant frequency, this effective current can resonantly drive power into that signal mode, provided that this current has a large geometric overlap with the electric field of this other mode, this quiet signal mode one. An example of that is something like a transverse electric mode of the same cavity, where instead the electric fields are azimuthal. And what you're going to try to do is try to read out this very quiet signal that's living on top of this very loud signal. The reason that can be done in practice is because one, the separation in frequency allows these modes to be distinguishable in practice. And also you can see this is coming from essentially the parity of the axion field, that the spatial profile of these modes can be in principle rather distinct. So we can talk about transferring power from some very loud driven mode that looks like this with an azimuthal B field to instead trying to only read out a very small amount of power in this azimuthal electric field. So this is only an efficient process, a resonant process, provided that the splitting between mode zero on the left and mode one on the right is split by an axion mass in terms of the resonant frequency. And we don't know what the axion mass is. So to scan and over a wide range of possibilities and make a wide range of guesses, a simple way to do that is just at some level is to push on the cavity and deform the geometry. For instance, if you push on the wall, this will deform the geometry of the cavity. And when you deform the geometry of the cavity, this will deform the frequency splitting between these two nearly degenerate modes and will allow you to scan over a wide range of possible axion masses, provided that the axion is very light, much lighter than a gigahertz. So this is one cartoon way to think about scanning. There are more developed ways to talk about scanning if people are interested or if I have some time towards the network.
Yeah, Asher, I have a question for you given on this. You need to make sure that your frequency is stable enough, right?
That's right.
So doesn't that introduce any problems? Usually putting, so because you're talking all the way down to frequencies of an inverse month, so that's a very tall requirement, especially if you push on stuff, it introduces other stuff, other sources of noise if you put something on.
That's right. So I'll be discussing this in a little bit more detail as we talk about noise.
Okay. Then let's discuss it later.
Okay. But I promise I will come back to it. It really requires actively monitoring, being very careful about what you're doing. It hasn't been done exactly how we want to do it, just to give you a sneak preview. It hasn't been done exactly how we want to do it, but there are some experimental achievements that give us hope that maybe it's doable.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Another question. So do you end up paying the factor of mass axion mass penalty by reading the signal mode anyways or not?
By what, the signal mode?
I mean, you were just getting rid of that penalty because of the axion mass being small, but yep. Now you're going to read this other mode that it's a bit split. Do you end up paying that mass penalty anyways by doing that?
Provided that the splitting is a very small fractional splitting, you don't end up paying that penalty.
I see.
If you're right, that parametric enhancement does not exist if the splitting is like an integer multiple or something. If you talk about like a gigahertz and 3 gigahertz, that enhancement essentially goes away. But if you talk about a gigahertz modes and let's say megahertz splittings, you, as long as it's a very small splitting, you still keep that parametric enhancement.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
No problem. Okay, so this is a not exactly a detailed explanation for how this would work, but to give you some slight more detail of how you could take advantage of these same two main benefits by looking for frequency conversion between these two nearly degenerate cavity modes and achieve goal number one and goal number two. But I've yet to tell you anything about goal number three. How can we go after small couplings in a mass-dependent independent way, just dig down deep into this parameter space? And to do that, I'm going to have to delve a little bit more into the specifics of the technology. But before getting there, let me just make an analogy to a harmonic oscillator. And I don't mean this in a deep way when physicists say everything is a harmonic oscillator. I really just mean it in a familiar setting. We're used to, from Jackson, thinking of the resonant modes of a cavity as obeying the same equations as a harmonic oscillator, where the driving term of that oscillator is usually something like an antenna that you place inside your cavity. But here what's playing the role of the driving term is not an antenna necessarily, but something like an axion effective current that's exciting these resonant modes, exciting this harmonic oscillator. Now, along those lines, any harmonic oscillator that you build in real life, any cavity that you build in real life, is imperfect. It has some small amount of damping or small amount of energy loss. And this is quantified by what people call a large quality factor or large Q factor of the system, which means very small damping. So the Q factor is inversely related to loss. And what this means more concretely is, let's imagine that our axion EMF is on resonance. And we ask, what is the amplitude of our resonant modes look like as a function of time? On resonance, what you'll do, what this axion current will do, is it will cause the resonant modes to linearly grow in time until they saturate after Q oscillations of your cavity. And this is just because this is when the damping terms of your system become important, which are quantified by the quality factor. What this means is that the ideal detector is something that has the largest possible Q, because this means you have a longer amount of time to resonantly drive in power into the system and suck in power. More technically, your total integrated signal power is typically characterized by the minimum of two timescales, tau sub r, which I'm calling this damping time or the ring up time, which is just the amount of time to saturate here, which is just, if let's say omega signal is a gigahertz, the frequency of your signal that you're reading out is Q oscillations of a gigahertz. However, you can only efficiently put in power provided that the axion remains in phase. But I told you before, if you observe the axion for long enough, you can think about its phase randomly jumping. So if it jumps out of phase, that's going to limit your signal power. And this axion coherence time, once again, is 1 over the kinetic energy of these particles. And for these axions virialized in the galaxy, this means that you're going to have to wait 10 to the 6 axion oscillations until the axion jumps out of phase with your resonator and limits how much power you can soak up into your detector. Now, what this means is there's a very obvious advantage of going to high Q. There are technical reasons that going to high Q always makes sense. But just from the point of view of signal power, there's a very obvious kind of way to see it. Let's say we start with a system with very low Q, and such that it's really the damping time, tau sub r, that's limiting our signal power. And we start ramping up Q to higher and higher values. Eventually, our signal power will saturate when the ring up time becomes the longer time scale than the axion coherence time. And this coherence time is essentially the bottleneck in the problem. That occurs at quality factors greater than roughly 10 to the 6 times the ratio of the frequency of your signal over the axion mass. Now, for static field setups, you're always reading out at an axion mass, so this ratio is 1, which means that your total integrated signal power saturates at Qs of 10 to the 6. However, if you're reading out at a gigahertz and you're trying to look for kilohertz axions, this implies that you're going to saturate at quality factors greater than 10 to the 12. So there's an obvious reason, just from the point of view of signal power alone, to talk about the highest possible Q systems. More technically, like I said before, when you consider signal to noise, there's typically always a benefit for going to higher Q, but this is kind of a nice just cartoon explanation to see why a higher Q system might benefit you in a very obvious way when you're talking about this heterodyne approach. So right away, having noted this benefit, we know what kind of cavities we should be talking about. This is because not out of just all cavities, but in fact, out of all macroscopically engineered systems we've ever made, superconducting cavities in particular are the most efficient oscillators. Out of all kind of big macroscopically engineered systems, commonly employing quality factors bigger than 10 to the 10 and sometimes much larger. So when asking, specifically why superconducting RF cavities. This point number one, the fact that they are extremely efficient, a very large Q, meaning a very long coherence time or damping time, is really the main reason why I'm considering these things today, because this enhances the signal. Furthermore, they already employ large oscillating fields, fields oscillating at a fraction of a Tesla in the frequency range of a gigahertz. Moreover, although they can be scaled up to be quite large in terms of their size, they can be manufactured and operated actively using nanometer scale precision. And I'll be talking a little bit more about that as we go along. So in principle, they can be operated as precision devices. And furthermore, they already have a little bit of momentum associated to them in terms of the fact that there are already experimentalists trying to use these things to look for new physics, which implies that there are people keen to apply decades worth of knowledge surrounding this technology to look for new interesting signals of physics beyond the standard model. But let me come to the main point here. The most important point is the fact that the huge quality factors of these systems is what's allowing us to enhance the signal. And in this sense, when I was showing you the reach, this is really how we're going to be able to dig down deep to get small couplings. Just take advantage of the very large quality factors of these systems, which typically span at the level of 10 to the 10 to 10 to the 12, something around there. So at this cartoon level, I've kind of given you a basic explanation for why, in principle, we should be able to talk about each of these kind of benchmarks, gaining access to very small masses, get better scaling and sensitivity to cover more of this dark matter target, and to dig down deep to cover more of this QCD axion band. But of course, that's not enough to really understand why this projection looks the way it does. And this is because we expect, for instance, as we try to probe smaller axion masses and bring these resonant modes closer together in terms of frequency, we expect a growing wall of noise to become very relevant. This is because the axion is causing transferring power between one mode and another mode, but there are mundane processes that can cause transfer of power. And these kind of background noise processes become more and more efficient as you bring the modes closer together in terms of their frequency. So let me spend the last minutes that I have telling you about noise and what that means in terms of sensitivity. So I should say at the onset, in some sense, this is what we've been trying to think about, or is what's been giving us, what we've been putting the most thought into over the, in writing these papers. So in some sense, deserves its own talk. I can point you towards technical points in the paper, and I'll be talking about a few of the technical points, but I'm not going to have enough time to talk about everything. So at some level, I'm going to have to gloss over some details, but happy to discuss more if people have questions as we go along. So let me first give you a cartoon explanation for the breakdown of various noise contributors, and then I'll be delving into some more specifics. But the reason that the shape looks the way it does is that because we expected very high, by very high, I mean the larger mass range here, where these resonant modes are separated maximally in this parameter space that we're going to consider, that we're just going to be limited by thermal occupation, essentially thermal photons living in our signal region. And this can be mitigated by how well we can cool these cavities down. And this will dictate the sensitivity over here. But as we bring these modes closer together and talk about probing smaller axion masses, we're going to open up a number of contributors to what I'm referring to into some grab bag term here, just called leakage noise. These can come from your oscillator that you're using to drive the cavity wiggling around, your cavity coupling mechanically to the environment. There are various things that can enter, but non-thermal noise contributions, what I'm just calling leakage noise here, are going to enter at small axion masses. So that's just the quick breakdown before I go into some more specifics. The simpler one to understand is what I'll begin with, which is just thermal noise, because it's typically the one that most axion projections assume is going to be the limiting noise source. So let me just say a few words about that. As I said before, you can think about this coming from the fact that your cavity walls have a temperature. Just from thermodynamics, they're going to emit thermal radio waves. And this means you're going to have some amount of thermal photons living in your signal region. Roughly, the power and noise is going to scale like the temperature of your cavity. So this means that you want to, if you're limited by thermal noise and you want to try to mitigate against that, you want to try to cool down your cavity to the lowest possible level. However, unlike experiments like ADMX or DM radio, we're talking about putting a lot amount of power into these cavities. We're driving the fields, power is being dissipated. These cavities are being heated up by the dissipation. And the amount of power being dissipated is typically on the scale of tens of watts. So the cooling power is typically larger than what's needed for something like ADMX or DM radio. So instead of cooling them down to the millikelvin, tens or hundreds of millikelvin level, the best that you can cool these cavities down is on the level of a few kelvin. So this means that thermal noise at this level is going to be larger because we're not, unlike ADMX, I'm not going to be talking about cooling these cavities down into their ground state. We're going to be talking about cooling down these cavities such that they still have a large occupation number of thermal photons floating around in your signal region. But in this limit, so I'll argue to you that this is a reasonable limit to be in for the larger axion mass range. And in this limit, we can do an apples to apples comparison because other axion experiments assume that they're going to be limited by thermal noise. And so we can kind of compare things in a simple apples to apples way. So let me make a comparison between this SRF cavity approach using an oscillating field and more traditional approaches using a static field using something like ADMX or DM radio. Now in blue, I've highlighted things that are advantages, in gray, things that are disadvantages. One advantage, once again, is just the overall strength of this parametric enhancement due to this heterodyne approach. The fact that we're reading out at a gigahertz, although static field setups always have to match to the axion mass. That's an enhancement or an advantage. Another advantage, as I said before, is that the quality factors of these systems are very huge. In principle, we can talk about quality factors as big as 10 to the 12, whereas static field cavities or static field experiments typically talk about much smaller quality factors. Disadvantages are the fact that you can't apply an arbitrarily large B field to a superconducting apparatus, at least at the level of how they exist now. So typically these things operate with a fraction of a Tesla field strength, whereas static field approaches typically talk about much larger B fields that they're applying to their approach. And furthermore, because we're talking about dissipated power, like I said before, we can't cool these things down to as low of temperatures. So that will increase the size of thermal noise. So I'll save you the technical details, but when you go through the estimate of the signal to noise, these quantities enter in this way. And it turns out that if you compare the signal to noise of this heterodyne approach compared to the signal to noise of the static field approach, this enhancement coming from the larger Q roughly cancels the disadvantage coming from the smaller B and the higher temperature. Such that at the end of the day, your signal to noise has some remnant after putting in these numbers, which is just a gigahertz over an axion mass in this thermal noise limited regime, which is really just a remnant of the first kind of thing that I was saying at the beginning, that these things have a parametric enhancement in terms of signal power. And it's this reason that we get a better scaling at a more detailed level in a thermal noise limited region at these masses up here. As we drop below a gigahertz, this discrepancy between static field approaches and our approach becomes more apparent.
Asher,
yeah.
May I ask how do I understand the linear difference in omega over m?
Sorry, what did you say?
Like the linear scaling of like omega over m in the difference. How do I understand that? Why it's linear, not power?
You have to go the way I can show you a slide, maybe a backup slide afterwards. The way that I think about it is it's not so. It's not so obvious. It's really not just a ratio of EMFs, because if you have some EMF of your signal, the EMF is enhanced linearly, but the way that your signal power looks like is something like EMF squared over resistance, and resistance looks like omega zero times the length of your cavity over Q. And so omega zeros kind of enter in multiple spots. At the end of the day, it's not just there's not a simple explanation. You kind of have to go through the algebra in a few lines to see it. I don't have a sharp way of explaining it, obvious why it's that power, but it's some remnant of the enhancement of the EMF.
Okay. I will wait.
Okay. if I forget, and there's a very good likelihood that I will, I have a backup slide that, I don't think it has all the algebra, but takes you through the estimate of the SNR. And I can, if I don't remember, remind me and I'll show it.
Okay.
And how are you sure that no noise scales with frequency at these for these axion masses? I mean, I understand your argument that it's probably thermal, but
yeah.
How are you sure that there's nothing else there? For instance, I could envision like there's some transient, like because you're cooling, so you're putting power into whatever metal you have around, right? Uh-huh. And then you're cooling it down. So then you will say, oh, in steady state, the noise will go just like temperature, but some in some like transient, maybe it won't go like temperature, will just like go like frequency because the fridge cannot answer so fast, right? I'm just speculating, but how are you sure that there's just, yeah, that it's just temperature? Are there measurements?
Are there measurements? Yeah, there are measurements. So there's, well, I'll say so there are a couple of previous measurements I'll talk about as we go along. One okay. is, and I'll mention this in more detail, but one that was actually motivated us to think about this is people tried to do similar things for gravitational wave experiments. And they essentially tried to measure how much noise was leaking into their readout, where they're trying to look for gravity waves, not axions, but the same idea applied. And they built a cavity with a fixed frequency splitting and tried to measure the noise leaking out. And by saying, and didn't see anything else. And by assuming that that noise leaking out is going to be a noise source, and there's also thermal noise limited, there's a region where that leakage noise drops below thermal noise. So that's what we're kind of basing this thing on. We're kind of anchoring to these previous measurements. It is possible, I mean, no one has built this exact experiment. It is possible that there are noise sources that we haven't thought of, but we've tried to be kind of systematic about it, to think as many sources as we can. And what's especially nice is, at least at higher masses, we're pretty confident that being thermal noise limited up here is the most reasonable, just because although this frequency splitting is very, very small, yeah, you're driving a large amount of power at a gigahertz, and you're looking for a tiny amount of power at a gigahertz plus an axion mass. Although the frequency splitting is small, these resonances are extremely narrow. These resonances are sub hertz. So you're many, many bandwidths away. And typically you have many essentially Lorentzian filtering. You have two Lorentzians and they're many bandwidths separated from each other. So you just have a very strong filtering in terms of these things being in different parts of frequency space. There are things that can just don't care about that.
But, and
we've tried to estimate those things, but
the gravitational, just to wrap up, the gravitational wave experiments, did they have the sensitivity to actually measure some sort of noise that will be important for you or not? Because maybe they are measuring like at just like much weaker sensitivity and then you don't know, right?
They measured this leakage noise at a kilohertz. And they essentially didn't see any other noise coming in. So that was their dominant noise source. And that's the measurement that we're leveraging off of.
Okay.
I don't have much more to say than that. I mean, of course they didn't scan over this entire frequency range. And you know, the one thing that's happening that's nice, as I'll say towards the end, is there are actually experimentalists we're talking to at CERN and Fermilab. They're just in a matter of months are actually going to do these measurements directly with the cavities that they have. And so we'll have some better understanding of what could enter.
Okay, thank you.
No problem. Mina, did you have a question as well?
Well, it's related. I'm thinking about seismic noise. One thing that's, or gravity gradient noise. I mean, this is going to hit you hard when you go below kilohertz.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. Okay, so I will talk about that. That's in fact
okay.
The next point. This previous gravity wave experiment measured vibrational noise without even trying to attenuate down to a hertz. So we can use that statement a little bit. The one difference is the fact that like this thing is kind of being bombarded. When they actually measured the mechanical vibrations coupling to these cavities, it was completely dominated by the fact that it's feeling the mechanical vibrations of the helium pump that it's sitting next to. So I'm going to show you different ways to bracket the size of mechanical vibrations that can enter, but we're pretty sure that as long as the mechanical vibrations are perturbatively modifying the geometry of the cavity, so it's not like the cavity's like crunching, that there's especially this high mass region is pretty robust. As I'm going to show you, as I bracket the mechanical vibrations and just increase their size by many orders of magnitude compared to the line that I'm showing you here, this sensitivity washes away considerably. But I still think this is jacking up the mechanical vibrations larger than what previous experiments measured them to be. And so, yeah, but we don't exactly know, but essentially the noise down, the reach down here is suffering from a huge amount of noise just kind of leaking in from geometric imperfections. So we don't expect something like seismic noise to be relevant. Essentially, there's just a much, much larger noise source. And the mechanical vibrations that we're putting in, we check some references and stuff, are consistent with actual seismic noise measurements. It's just the fact that like what we're putting in at this level are vibrations that we think are much, much bigger than something like seismic noise. But I'm happy to discuss more. Maybe when I get to that point.
This is what I mean by seismic noise, things shaking, whatever that may mean. Yeah, so like, that will happen at lower frequencies than a megahertz for sure, most of the time.
Right. So we're leveraging on the fact that there are direct measurements of this particular kinds of cavities down to a hertz. Fermilab is planning, they have a time series of their wobbles, and they're planning on doing a time series estimate or just a time series analysis of these wobbles, and that will give us a better handle on subhertz. But even compared to this, I'm going to show you how these estimates degrade, let's say, if we increase what we think is reasonable by something like 10 orders of magnitude.
So the other thing I want to ask is about, you're assuming here that you have a meter cube size cavity with a Q of 10 to the 12. Is that been achieved, or is it something that you guys are extrapolating?
It has not been achieved with the, the highest Q that's been achieved is several times 10 to the 11 and slightly smaller volumes. So we are extrapolating a bit here, but the accelerator engineers that we've been talking to at Slack and Fermilab think this is not so crazy, especially because once you give up on the geometries that are optimal for accelerating charged particles to build an accelerator, there are design strategies that you can use to make these more reasonable. So probably a quality factor of 10 to the 12 is probably not as hard as making something like a cubic meter, just because people haven't made a dedicated cavity before with such high quality factors of a cubic meter. Although the experimentalists that we talk to say, if you make it bigger, typically the quality factors become larger. So people haven't built this exact cavity before. So we are extrapolating a bit, but the experimentalists we're talking to are somewhat optimistic.
Okay, thanks.
Problem.
I can ask you a very basic question. I mean, the setup is a resonance search, right? It's not really broadband. And so when you go to lower frequencies, like below hertz or so, how much time are you assuming that you can run the experiment? Like, is this done assuming one year of run?
So this experiment actually kind of morphs into a broadband experiment once the axion becomes very, very light.
Okay.
You think about these two resonances, and they're both, let's say they're resonances that are very, very narrow, and you're bringing them closer together to probe that axion mass. Once you bring them on top of each other, they're now, in theory, in principle, sensitive to axions just lighter than the width of those resonances. Because in that sense, once you bring them together, you're just sensitive to any mass below that width, because the axion is going to cause power to remain within that resonant bandwidth of those experiments. In making this plot, it would probably not be feasible to do a single experiment to cover all this parameter space, just because this is so many e-folds. And to make the comparison with DM radio sensible, we chose a comparable e-fold time as something like DM radio. So that's something like, I think it's a little bit less than 10 to the 7 seconds. So if you take 10 to the 7 second e-fold time and integrate across this whole thing, that's something between 5 and 10 years of total integration time. But what probably be done is, and talking to the experimentalists that we're thinking about, because we're most confident in this high mass regime, it would the first thing that's probably going to be done is just cover this high mass regime. And there's a sensible way of maybe you could cover the low mass regime with a single run as well, provided that you just run on the scale of minutes. Doing a full scanning approach like this would take several years to be able to do.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. So I've already kind of hinted at some aspects of this, but let me say some slight more details of noise. I'm going to have to gloss over some of the contributors, but I'm going to identify what I think is the most important contributor, which is in regards to this mechanical noise a little bit. So the cartoon way of thinking about this before I give you some numbers is ideally what you'd like to do is to take, let's say, an external oscillator and have that oscillator prepare a delta function in frequency and prepare your cavity as a delta function in frequency at a gigahertz. However, that's not what's going to happen. If you look up a commercial oscillator, they quantify what's called phase noise. This is, you think about the oscillator with a little phase that's jumping around. So this causes a spread in power in terms of frequency space. Also, your cavity is mechanically coupling to the environment, and this causes frequency to spread around. So what this means at a cartoon level is that if you look at your power spectral density, namely just think of it as power per unit frequency in a certain mode. In your driven mode, ideally, and I'm showing you this as a function as a step away from omega zero, so separation from a gigahertz. So ideally, your driven mode, which is this black line, should just be a peak at the left. However, the oscillator has a width and it has a tail. And this tail has contributions from the oscillator itself, from mechanical vibrations in the environment. And you're looking for a signal that's shown here in green that's peaking at MA away from omega zero. So this means as this driven mode develops a tail, you're losing this frequency distinction between your signal and your loud driven mode, because now your loud driven mode is kind of coexisting in your signal region. In principle, that wouldn't be a problem if you had perfect geometric discrimination of these two modes, but you never do. So as you increase the geometric discrimination, you can lower this noise, but with some fixed level of geometric discrimination, some power is going to leak into your signal region, and you're going to attribute that to something, and it's going to constitute some noise. And the reason I'm showing you this is it gives you kind of a cartoon way of understanding why this leakage noise becomes greater as I talk about smaller axion masses. As I talk about smaller axion masses and I'm looking for a peak over here and over here and over here, I'm getting closer to where all my driven power is concentrated. And so for a fixed amount of geometric discrimination, I'm going to have more power leaking into my signal region. So this is kind of the quick way to understand why leakage noise is larger as I try to probe smaller axion masses. But now let me say some slightly more details about some of these contributors. But in doing that, like I promised, a lot of these statements are not things that we're just guessing, but based on a recent empirical finding from either existing or previous experiments. So some of these previous endeavors provide some empirical handles on these kinds of noise levels that I'll discuss. So one thing that I've alluded to, and this is in fact the motivation for why we considered this for axions, was an experiment that was being pushed. The theoretical effort goes back into the 70s, but the experimental effort stopped around 20 years ago. Essentially, the experimental effort was essentially pulled up, was purposely stopped. The funding was purposely stopped because people were told to go into the big ramping up of interferometers like Virgo and LIGO. But what they were looking for, it was a collaboration between CERN and INFN in Europe around a couple of decades ago to look for the same signal of frequency conversion, not induced by axions, but induced by high frequency gravitational waves coupling to your cavity and causing transfer in power. This is an example of a prototype that they built. This whole effort was pulled in the early 2000s. But what they were looking for was essentially trying to drive either symmetric combinations of modes and looking for power leaking into anti-symmetric combinations of modes. So modes that have spatially overlapping spatial profiles, but kind of differing in their phase and frequency. The empirical findings that these people made with this prototype cavity are quite impressive. And these are people that we've actually actively talked to as well about these points, is the fact that solely from geometry alone, by actively monitoring and controlling the cavity, they were able to discriminate the power between these two modes, even when they were just split by a kilohertz at the level of 10 to the minus 14. And this is coming just coming from controlling the geometry alone of this cavity. So this is an overall suppression independent of the frequency difference of 14 orders of magnitude in terms of power. They also directly measured some noise sources. They looked at the positions of these mechanical resonances, how much noise was coupling to the mechanical resonances at a different point in frequency space. And they measured these mechanical vibrations coupling to their cavity down to around a hertz and found that it was largely dominated by just the cryogenic system that this thing was coupling to in the lab. Without even, I should say, they didn't even try to do any attenuation of these cavities. So this is what they saw. So this is kind of experimental endeavor number one that I want to talk about. Experimental endeavor number two that we're going to leverage on. Oh, I should say I'm running a little bit late. I can try to go quickly, or
you can take some more time. We're starting late.
Keep going. Okay. Keep
going. Yeah, don't worry.
I don't have too many more slides, I don't think, but I don't want to gloss over anything. So okay, but if it gets to a point where people, you know, should be able to leave, I can conclude quickly and come back to it if people want to hang around. Okay, anyway, so experiment number two that I want to talk about is called Dark SRF, and it's actually based at Fermilab now. They're using pairs of these cavities to look for things called dark photons to do something like a light shining through wall experiment. And what they've done is, in fact, I think what they told me is that they just hired somebody from LIGO to try to attenuate these mechanical vibrations. And what they've been able to do by actively monitoring the cavity in real time and trying to correct for it, they've attenuated the vibrations of their cavity walls down to a small fraction of a nanometer. In fact, in this picture, you can see Roni holding a wrench. So he's deeply tied to the experimental effort. Things that they also were able to do were resolve the thermal noise in these cavities, and they were able to actively attenuate these mechanical vibrations on the scale of 10 minutes so far. But what they plan on doing in the near future is extending this to like a week long time scale, and also directly measuring some of these noise sources that are relevant for us, relevant for this frequency conversion idea. So let me say a little bit more, some slightly more details about mechanical vibrations now. So as I said before, let's imagine an ideal scenario where the oscillator is not causing any noise. So you have some external oscillator driving a waveguide that couples to your cavity, and this oscillator is pumping in power exactly at a delta function in frequency space at a gigahertz. However, your cavity's wobbling around. So you can think of your cavities having some radius that's wobbling around in time, some fractional displacement. And that fractional displacement, one way to think about it is it's going to cause your resonant frequency to wobble around. So one way to think about this is you're driving a wobbly resonator. Once again, this is going to cause some power to live in your signal region from mechanical vibrations. Roughly, the way to think about, let's say, the power per unit frequency in this mechanical noise is that it will scale as how much power you're putting into your apparatus. It will scale as how well you can control the geometry of your cavity to enforce that no power is kind of jumping between these two modes. And this requires exquisite geometric control. And it, of course, also depends on how big the forces are that are coupling to your cavity. In particular, if you have some force that is oscillating your cavity at an axion mass, this can mimic an axion signal. This can cause power to jump between your driven mode and your signal mode if that the frequency of your wobble is at an axion mass. So one open question is, how can we think about normalizing this force, the essentially the Newton squared per hertz, the amount of force per unit frequency that couples to our cavity? Now, there's an absolute kind of lower floor that we can talk about, which is just coming from something you can derive, for instance, from what's called the fluctuation dissipation theorem or the equipartition theorem, just from thermodynamics, which is the fact that our cavity has a temperature and the walls are going to be vibrating due to their temperature. This is some very lower floor in how big they're wobbling, but we expect a much larger set of vibrations. So I'm not going to consider this. I'm usually going to be considering something like, you know, 10 to 15 orders of magnitude larger than this. So we expect much larger vibrations, like I said before, coming from the fact that this thing is sitting in a cryogenic environment with the things like a liquid helium pump wobbling around. And there are two scenarios that I'm going to present to you right now. let's imagine one scenario is that I have a mechanical force coupling to my cavity at a frequency of one of its mechanical resonances, what I'm calling omega mechanical. This will contribute some RMS of the size of the wobble of the walls in terms of a distance scale. And we can normalize this because, for instance, Fermilab has said that they've been able to attenuate these wobbles down to a fraction of a nanometer. Another possibility is, let's say we have some force that suddenly turns on at a very low frequency, at some frequency below what I'm calling omega wall. So some wall and force that turns on at this low frequency, and it's exciting the cavity mechanically off resonance. It still can't be too big, or else it would wobble the cavity much larger than what these measurements have seen. So there's two ways to kind of bracket it. So what I'm going to leverage on is the fact that, like I said, this dark SRF experiment has attenuated the wobbles down to a fraction of a nanometer. This MAGO collaboration has measured the unattenuated force coupling to their cavity down to a hertz, and has also measured like kind of the characteristic positions and spacings of these mechanical resonances. What they found is that these mechanical resonances typically live above a kilohertz and are spaced approximately every 100 hertz. Now, a couple ways to bracket this is, let's say there is some force living at the position of our lowest mechanical resonance down at a kilohertz. If we don't want that force to be too big to wobble our cavity bigger than a nanometer, this is roughly the size of this force, roughly 10 orders of magnitude greater than these thermal vibrations. And one optimistic assumption is to say this is normalized at a kilohertz. Let's imagine that this is flat at frequencies below a kilohertz. That's one optimistic assumption. Another assumption we can make is, let's say a wall of force turns on at a hertz, or maybe a little bit below a hertz, and is exciting the cavity off resonance at these very low frequencies, but that still can't be too big. This is, in fact, predicts a force that's actually comparable to the unattenuated force measured by this MAGO experiment at a hertz. And I'll be showing you, in fact, when I bracket this reach and start just artificially inflate this noise, I'm going to show you actually something a couple orders of magnitude bigger than this. But this gives you a sense of how we can try to think about mechanical vibrations coupling to our cavity, which can cause power to jump from one mode to another. So just to give you a sense, this is our most optimistic assumption, this 10 to minus 13 newtons squared per hertz, which is roughly 10 orders of magnitude greater than just thermal vibrations. And this essentially normalized at a kilohertz, assuming it's coupling to mechanical resonance here, and then assuming the mechanical force is flat. But we can imagine just increasing this force by something like 8 orders of magnitude. We see as we start doing this, largely what's preserved is this lower mass region, because it's just completely swamped by the fact that the axion is living where the driven mode is being populated. So you don't need mechanical vibrations to transfer power. Just any small amount of geometric imperfection is just going to cause power to leak in, even if it's static. Now, at higher masses too, this leak noise dies off. So we can keep pumping this up, and this is just an exercise we do in our papers. In fact, in our more recent paper, as long as this force is just perturbative, okay, as long as it's not gonna like crunch your cavity, it's a perturbative effect on your cavity, and you still hold good geometric discrimination, this region more or less lives, but this kind of region flattens out, and this region lives as well. But what's really susceptible to the size of these mechanical vibrations is this intermediate region here. But we think this top line is probably too pessimistic, according to people we've talked to. Okay, so one last thing. Sorry for going so over time. One last thing that I'd like to point out is the statement about this QCD axion. Now, there are other experiments to go after the QCD axion, so this is not exactly an apples-to-apples comparison. One experiment is the so-called Casper experiment, which is a very ambitious experiment, which you should maybe think of this reaches a couple decades off, but it's going after a different coupling, so the gluon coupling. And for the QCD coupling, I can always, for a fixed model of the QCD axion, I can translate that into an equivalent symmetry breaking scale and put it on the same plot here. And you can see if Casper eventually does what it wants to do and DM radio does it, what it wants to do, this leaves a little remaining gap. And what we think is especially exciting is that this can help close the gap. So to summarize, this idea of really the power of this idea is oscillating the field, taking advantage of this heterodyne detection strategy to look for ultralight axions. And the ideal setting to take advantage of the signal power using a heterodyne strategy is the largest possible Q system. And in terms of a macroscopic system with large fields, that can be run in a precision way. The kind of the obvious setting is using something like a superconducting cavity. And it's really these statements that are allowing potentially the ability to test each of these kind of theoretical benchmarks, the QCD axion, this dark matter motivated parameter space, and this fuzzy dark matter regime. In terms of experimental developments, I'm not a part of directly, but people that we're talking to is that there are measurements that will happen very soon at Fermilab and CERN using cavities that they already have lying around to try to get a better handle on these noise sources. And we're beginning to do some accelerator engineers at SLAC are beginning to put in some proposals to do some R&D on a dedicated detector design, as opposed to these guys who are just trying to measure some noise sources with the accelerator optimized cavities that they already have. In terms of theoretical opportunities, something I didn't really have a chance to talk about is that in our newer paper, we talked about a kind of a natural stepping stone to get to the scanning strategy, which is just to build a cavity with a fixed geometry, a fixed frequency position of these modes, and turn it on. And in fact, just by turning it on, you would have, within a few minutes, you would have a lot of sensitivity without having to scan. Although, of course, from general principles, the sensitivity wouldn't be as impressive. We're also trying to revitalize this idea of looking for high-frequency gravitational waves using these cavities. For instance, coming from the fact that the gravitational wave can couple directly to the electromagnetic modes in your cavity. So that's something that we're trying to revitalize and get a better theoretical footing on, just to see how good it can be. And some perhaps more ambitious question and slightly more open-ended is, are there other interesting theoretical models to pursue using this heterodyne approach? Could you down-convert a very high-mass axion into a lower frequency range, because that's more optimal for some reason? Could you go after different couplings for the axion? Could you go after different models of ultralight bosonic dark matter, for instance? So I think there are some still open questions to begin exploring. And I'll end there. Sorry about going over, and thanks for all the questions.
Thank you very much. It was very interesting and clear talk. Are there more questions?
So, Asher, I have one more question. Sure. So, if you can go to such low frequency, why not do gravitational wave detection at, I don't know, subhertz on Earth?
Yeah. So we're trying to revitalize this gravitational wave idea. And the hope was, because these MAGO people looked at predominantly just the mechanical vibrations of the cavity, coupling, causing transfer in power. And we've been looking at this electromagnetic coupling of gravitational waves and hoping that that can maybe overcome some noise issues. That signal dies pretty rapidly at low frequencies. So in fact, we're trying to, the scaling is not as optimal for gravitational waves. You don't get this, the sensitivity isn't as great for gravitational waves. So when you put in all the noise sources for a gravitational wave estimate using this idea, the reach is what we think so far pretty crappy at low frequencies. So what we're trying to leverage on is maybe there's something interesting to do at higher frequencies. But
this is confusing, you know, because the graviton doesn't have derivative couplings. It's just, it couples to mass. This is the why does it have suppression of its couplings?
Sorry, I was talking about the electromagnetic coupling, which, you know, it comes in like, right, you can write the gravity wave effect in terms of its electromagnetic coupling as similarly like an effective current, although that's not the way people usually talk about it.
Yeah.
It's just like a modification of Maxwell's equations, and all the corrections come in like Riemann times some distance squared. And so because Riemann is, it's typically the way it enters is like an omega squared L squared effect. Mm-hmm. In terms of the gravitational wave. So you don't get something that's unsuppressed by the small frequency of the gravitational wave when you're talking about the electromagnetic coupling. But when you talk about very low frequencies, it's the mechanical coupling that dominates. And so when we put in that estimate, the estimates don't look so good at low. The reach always dies at low frequency because you have these much larger noise sources.
Yeah, of course.
The reach looks pretty crappy. In fact, we don't even know if it can beat like cosmological constraints. So So we're not exactly sure, but it's something that we're trying to, it's very, very fresh right now. So I probably shouldn't say too much. That's why we're trying to think of this, trying to revitalize this kilohertz to, let's say, gigahertz frequency range.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
It's also a little tough to do gravitational waves as well, because these modes can't be really perpendicular to each other like the axion cases.
No. I'm talking about doing a dedicated experiment.
But in a dedicated experiment, the modes typically have to be parallel to each other, and the ability to discriminate, the mechanical power actually sensitively depends on that. So how mechanical vibrations can cause transfer in power become much more significant once the modes have a non-zero spatial overlap. For the case of the axion, the modes can be locally orthogonal, like E0 and E1 can be orthogonal at every point in space in the cavity, and that really suppresses the mechanical vibrations. For gravity wave, you actually want to enhance that, and enhancing the signal, you typically enhance the noise, just because the noise and the signal are typically the same in the case of vibrations. So it's not as easily disentangled from the point of view of gravitational waves. And that's why we were hoping that the photon coupling could save us at higher frequencies.
Okay.
Well, I have another question. Like if we go to your like a plot, like what cuts off like your sensitivity on the right?
Good. So it was a function in my Mathematica. but the reason that I put it there is because really we derived all our expressions assuming that it's a very small fractional splitting between these two things, and the reach changes slope once the splitting becomes order one comparable to gigahertz. So in fact, this doesn't keep scaling this way. It actually, the slope sharply changes and becomes worse as you talk about higher frequencies. And so we just decided to cut it off there. Also, there are additional noise sources that can be more prevalent when you're talking about larger frequency splittings, like nonlinearities in the cavity, which typically populate noise close to the harmonics, like at a gigahertz, 2 gigahertz, 3 gigahertz. Nonlinearities can populate strong, large amounts of noise at those higher frequencies. So for that reason as well, we cut it off.
And those nonlinearities won't be important at lower frequencies?
It's some of those nonlinearities won't be as important. Definitely for axions heavier than, let's say, the bandwidth of the cavity, those nonlinearities will probably not be an issue. Because the nonlinearities are going to be populating noise at kind of harmonic multiples of what you're oscillating at. But there are additional effects that we're trying to actively look into that might be relevant at the very lowest frequencies, which could limit, and people will usually talk about within the scheme of nonlinearities. They usually talk about it like using the language of like four wave mixing or something. Like you have 2 photons come in and 2 photons come out, and you think about conserving energy amongst that. That's not a problem at higher frequencies, because if you want 2 photons at a gigahertz to come in and 1 photon to come out at your signal frequency, you want the other outgoing photon to be at some lower frequency where some mode doesn't really exist. But if all those photons can be approximately degenerate, which is the regime of the lowest axion masses, potentially those nonlinearities can be a problem. So that's something that we're aware of it, and we're trying to figure out how to calculate it, but it's probably just going to require some kind of measurement that hasn't been done before, that maybe some experimentalist friend that can do for us. That is something that this very low frequency regime is sensitive to, unlike these other regimes.
So if you could increase the resonant frequency of the cavity, as Jung was suggesting before, you could potentially push this to higher masses.
Yeah. In fact, typically the reach for technical reasons. Oh, I never showed your slide, Curly. I'm sorry. I can show you if you're still interested. Typically, the reach falls off as you start increasing the baseline frequency of the cavity. So if you now, like, let's say you don't take a gigahertz cavity, or like, don't take like a sub gigahertz cavity, but you take like a 10 gigahertz cavity or something, the reach will move to the right, but it will also, the bottom line will move up. So the reach will degrade. Mm-hmm. And this comes from technical reasons when you're estimating the SNR. But I should say the original kind of idea for this goes back to a paper from Sakiti from like 2010 or something, where he talked about transitions between a gigahertz and like 10 gigahertz. So like kind of very high frequency transitions. And it's something we never looked into because it just seems kind of complicated. You're kind of living, once you go to very high frequencies, you can't think of the cavity as just one mode and another mode. When you go to very high frequencies, there's a densely packed forest of modes. So it becomes kind of a much more complicated system. It's not just two resonators, it's many, many resonators all potentially coupling to each other. So that's, you could do it, but it's a little bit more of an involved of a problem, I would say.
Yeah, okay. So
I have a quick question, sorry.
Please go ahead.
Go ahead. Yeah.
The slide where you show the two different cavities, like, you know, the normal one where you just have a field, a magnetic field going in, and then for the heterodyne one, do you have any kind of external magnetic field?
The point here is the magnetic fields in these cavities are just supplied by exciting the cavities. So you don't have to, unlike ADMX, where you take a cavity and you drive some big B field across it, when you excite these cavities and you just, like, let's say you put an antenna in the cavity, you're naturally, the B fields that we're leveraging on are the B fields that are just excited already. So you don't have to do anything extra.
So that's where you'd be using the radio frequency pulses, I assume?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So you have some external oscillator that's pulsing your cavity in the radio frequency range. You have some waveguide that pumps power in there, or you can think about it like kind of the Jackson problem is to take a little antenna and drive a little current at a gigahertz back and forth inside your cavity. And if that antenna or that little piece of wire has a geometric overlap with the electric field here, it will just cause the whole cavity to resonantly excite in that mode, including the B fields as well.
Right. Would you also look at like different types of pulses? You know, like I'm just trying to see like how much of this would be related to like an NMR. You know, like there are different types of pulses which would give you different types of times that you showed us, like, you know, the tau. I actually forgot what the subscript was there. That. So, you know, I'm just wondering, like, if you've looked into the different types of pulse sequences.
We've really just looked at... like looking up one of these commercial oscillators, and they, you know, they say they can operate at a gigahertz with a very, very narrow width. So like a frequency width of something like a millihertz. So the way that we're thinking about driving these cavities is at a gigahertz, centered at a gigahertz with a little box around it at the level of a millihertz or so. So we haven't looked at any variations upon that. When you said NMR, it got me thinking, I mean, like, maybe there's some crazy ideas of where you could put spin polarized material in these cavities.
As long as you know the properties of the materials themselves, you could actually, in theory, find... Well, what I mean is, like, yeah, there could be two simultaneous, you know, experiments to like, prove whatever you found in the first one, rather than just looking at, you know, like the noise would be different.
Oh, sure.
It would just help, you know, solidify your results.
So, right. In fact, along those lines, like if you saw something or if you weren't sure it was noise or signal, you could build a cavity or deform the existing cavity such that the modes have a slightly different geometric outweigh. Like they're the spatial profile is different. Not even changing the pulse, but just change the spatial profile, and that could, how that affects the noise and how that affects the signal is very different. So that's another way of kind of sniffing it out. But people, I mean, also, but what you're getting to as well, a lot of people play with different ideas of kind of a little bit more ambitious ideas of where you try to populate the cavity with multiple modes at the same time and try to look for axion physics like that. It doesn't have to be just populating one mode. Maybe you're populating a couple. Things get a little bit more tricky that way. But yeah, in principle, there are variations upon this idea.
A last question would be, does it matter where in the world you would have this particular experiment? Like, you know, I mean, of course you would try to avoid like places with active seismic, you know, but the seismic activity, but I don't know, like, would you suggest something higher up, more deep into the ground?
Because we expect most of this vibrational noise just to be dominated by the system that you, like the cooling system that you have to place these things in, where in the world you put it is probably not too important in this sense. Okay. And it, like, even if you're worried about maybe like cosmic rays or some radiation coming in, there's like potentially hundreds of electrons flying around inside of this cavity at any given time that like external radiation is probably not going to be the main concern. You're ripping material off the walls typically. So I think for that reason, the location dependence is not too important, provided that you're probably at a place where they can manufacture these cavities. That would be the ideal place.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much. This is a great talk.
Thank you. Thanks for the questions.
Well, the place should be Fermilab, right?
Yeah, it's some weird combination. Yeah, exactly. Where people are doing R&D, like Sami Tantawi, who's at Slack, is doing R&D on this. We've talked to people at CERN that want to do noise measurements with their existing cavities. And then the people at Fermilab also want to begin doing existing noise measurements at cavities. But Slack doesn't build cavities. So Fermilab and CERN build cavities. So ideally Fermilab, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe we can...
Okay, yeah, sure.
We can thank Asher again and stop the recording here, and then we can keep discussing for people who want to get.